Thank you very much and good morning, everybody. Thank you to the AUSC and to the University of Padua for the invitation. I had the opportunity yesterday in glorious sunshine to walk around this beautiful city and to look at some of the magnificent palaces and public buildings. And I stumbled across the botanical gardens in the centre of Padua, which I understand is the oldest or claims to be the first established botanical garden. And I was quite impressed to see an inscription on the gate which said that they had very early recognised the connection between nature and culture, and also that they were one of the first to institute the studies of the new science of ecology. So I concluded from that the founding fathers of Padua were not Christian Democrats, nor socialists, nor even liberals, but in fact were Greens. So I'm happy to be here in the first Green city. I'm a member of the European Green Party Executive Committee, and there's a distinction to be made here because I was actually introduced as a member of the Greens IFA group in the Parliament, and this is one of those confusing situations where we have easy recognition of the groups that function in the Parliament, since they tend to be in the news, and not so easy recognition of the political families, the political parties that we're talking about. But the Greens, like the other parties, their groupings inside the Parliament form coalitions. So in fact there is a coalition between Green Party members and members of the European Free Alliance, who are mainly national or independent parties like the Scottish Nationalist Party, for example. And although we work closely together, we are two separate organisations, and in your dossier you will find a separate manifesto from the IFA party. And to greater or lesser extent, I think all of us, in terms of the political groupings in the Parliament, are coalitions of various interests, sometimes uncomfortable and sometimes with very odd bedfellows, but that's the demand of making up a group in the European Parliament. And I suspect after May the 25th, with the arrival of quite a few new political parties and activists, that there will be even more odd coalitions formed. And maybe later we'll talk about the challenge that you gave of making sure that the rest of us, those of us who are already there, don't create a grand block in the centre of Parliament. I think that's not going to happen, but we'll discuss that later on. Our process of creating our manifesto followed a similar pattern to everyone else's. It took us about 12 months. I was a member of the editorial group. We eventually, after various working groups and drafting sessions, produced a document which was adopted by unanimity in our Congress in February in Brussels. I think perhaps the distinction between the Greens and the other families is that it was driven much more by the European Green Party itself, rather than being a series of feed-ins from the national parties. But this is something which perhaps we need to discuss. It's only been 10 years since European political parties were created, or at least since the regulation allowing us to form official European Green Parties was in place. The Greens were the first to do so. We did it, in fact, in Rome in 2004. And we probably spent the last 10 years wondering what we were supposed to be there for. And so to that extent, this conference is a timely reminder and question as to what our role should be. But I think in those 10 years, we've at least learned for ourselves what we want to be, and we've learned how to work together with our national parties without being just a federation of national parties. And if we have time later on, I'd like to discuss that further. I've got one correction to make and one commentary to the speech of Professor Massia, who said that parties were still in the main funded at the European level by the national parties. That's no longer the case, certainly not for the Greens, and I imagine the rules apply to everyone else. 85% of our funding comes from the European Parliament, and only 15% or so comes from our member parties. So to that extent, we are less dependent financially on our member parties than we used to be, and those rules have been in place for 4 or 5 years, I think, now. The commentary I wanted to make was against his comment that there was not much substantive difference between the manifestos of the various parties. We're all in the same game, so we're all pitching for your votes for the European Parliament, so to that extent there is a common thread naturally which runs through the manifestos. But you have, as I understand the students have, been invited to read through all the manifestos. I hope you find some quite significant and substantive differences between them, certainly in terms of the Greens manifesto. If you look at the sections on climate, on transatlantic trade, on legal migration, on digital Bill of Rights, on renewable energy and jobs, on sustainable agriculture and fisheries, I hope you'll find enough in there to distinguish us from our colleagues on the bench here. If you can't find much substantive difference, we've done a poor job. And I'm pretty convinced that within the context, the overall framework of these elections, there is a real choice. And it's a shame, in fact, that the European left are not here, because if you read their manifesto, they also have quite a distinctive programme. And as the polls are proposing or suggesting that they will conceivably make up the fourth largest or even possibly the third largest group in the next parliament, it's something that you perhaps need to take seriously. And I was also encouraged yesterday, I saw a comment from a professor of EU politics, Michael Kading, I think his name is, from the University of Duisburg, who'd been through the programmes and the campaigns and announced that the Greens were most clearly oriented towards the European issues of all the political parties. So rather than this being a series of 28 national elections, which is in reality what it's going to be, the Greens, amongst the other families, have been trying to create this European demos, this European political space, and his credit to us was that we'd come the closest so far in terms of making a European campaign out of this. I think, like others, that if I attempt to go through our 30-odd page manifesto line by line, A, you'll be bored silly, and B, the chairman will stop me. But we have, as others have, a simple 10-point programme, a 10-point summary, which is on our website, europeangreens.eu, and that gives you, in essence, the key points that we see. And again, seeking to highlight the issues on which we want to concentrate, item one is climate change. Very few references to climate change in the other manifestos. For us, this is one of the most urgent and pressing issues and cannot be ignored. The political will, which has not so far been there, to make real change, to come up with proposals for binding targets in Paris next year at the Conference of the Parties, really is one of the most urgent, pressing issues, not because in my lifetime, but in the lifetime of my grandchildren. This is going to create, at the moment, unless we start to go in a different direction, a catastrophe. And part of the problem of politics is that it's short-termist, and therefore the political agendas tend to be fixed for the next 5 years. We need to be looking at the next 50 years, and we need to be generating the political will which will enable us to make decisions globally that will enable us to mitigate climate change, because if we do not stop, the science tells us that we are heading for a 4 degrees increase in the global climate based on pre-industrial levels, and that will create the most incredible reaction in terms of extreme climate events, in terms of climate migration, in terms of economic devastation. So whilst we can discuss the issues of the day, for me that is something which comes first and top of the list. The other items, just briefly, are creating new green jobs, a green economy, building a social Europe, letting the youth reclaim their future, strengthening citizens' digital rights, sustainable food production, something very important for Italy, taming the financial industry, fighting for tax justice. I don't know how many of you know that Starbucks, for example, don't pay any tax in Europe because they shift all their profits offshore perfectly legally. There is a need for an overhaul of our tax system, and there need to be rules established at EU level that will create the basis for that. We want to reinvigorate also European democracy by enhancing and increasing the use that the Parliament has of its existing powers. We talked earlier about how Professor Lungo described the power structure, but she underplayed, I think, the potential power of the European Parliament, which has the right of co-decision, the right of equal legislative assent to most now of EU legislation. And on those occasions when Parliament has decided to flex its muscles, and there have been a few, Parliament has won. Parliament is able to say no. Parliament said no to the anti-counterfeiting treaty, for example, ACTA. It's thrown out various pieces of legislation that it didn't like. And when we can build a consensus between enough of the political groups that something is not adequate or something is wrong or something has been done incorrectly, Parliament is able to throw it out. Now, it doesn't use that power very often, and it requires, as you can imagine, an enormous amount of negotiation between the people or the parties represented at these top tables. But it can happen. And Parliament needs to learn to use those powers more forcibly. It needs to claim its prerogative. Otherwise, exactly as Professor Lungo described, we effectively become a subservient or a servant of a political system which is driven by the European Council. And that is not a participatory democracy. That is not a transparent process. And my experience working in the European Parliament is that if you have the right case and if you really approach it correctly, you can persuade your colleagues in Parliament to take a collective line. Coming back now to the piece of the jigsaw puzzle, the piece that doesn't quite fit, which is the European political parties. We're still in the process of inventing a role for ourselves, but I do think that we are a lot more than merely a confederation or representative of our constituent member parties. If I look at the role which the European Green Party takes for itself, not only do we draft the Common Manifesto and run our common campaign, this is our fourth common campaign now, but we play quite a large role in supporting and facilitating the growth of our member parties around the EU and indeed outside the EU. We're not just an EU party, we are a European party. And we've helped to grow or rebuild or reconstruct green parties in Spain, in Croatia, even in Italy and in Hungary, where previously they had collapsed or been dysfunctional or not existed. And we, as the European Green Party, have facilitated on the ground the rebuilding of those parties, bringing together green actors to create new political movements. So there's a real function there to be performed, which no other part of this jigsaw, no other element of this complex EU structure could do. We produce policy platforms. If you read just two examples, one on our website is a series of documents called the Green New Deal, which have been produced by the EGP with the consent of our parties and the contribution of our member parties, but the motivation for that was driven by the centre. And if you look at our policy on TTIP, the transatlantic trade negotiations, which were referred to, which we oppose, you'll see also that there is a strong policy platform on that. And we represent the political families increasingly at EU level inside the institutions. So we are rather begrudgingly being recognised as the spokespersons for our political family. So, just to conclude, we agree, I think, all of us, that there is as yet no real European political space in public. It exists in our own rarefied world, but it's not accessible to the public and not visible to the public. Daniel just mentioned the idea of transnational lists, and that's something which we think would really transform things, in addition to the idea of putting forward lead candidates who could become the President of the European Commission, the idea that electors themselves will have the possibility to vote for a list of candidates which is not a national list but which is a transnational list, would open the eyes, we hope, of the electorate to the fact that they are electing something bigger than merely another set of politicians who are nationally oriented. And in fact, the Greens have gone some way towards this in an informal way by having various candidates standing on the lists of other member states, which is possible under the law. So we've had an Italian elected in Belgium, we've had a Danny Cohn-Bendit, who's a French-German leading politician, or was, he's just retiring now, was elected alternately in Germany and France, So it is possible to create this trans-European dimension, but it requires a lot of effort on our part. I think, finally, I would like to say that we're getting there. And if, as part of congresses like this, there is a growing debate and awareness of the need to push, present, argue for, fight for, scrap for recognition of the European Parliament and of the transnational nature of the Parliament, then these congresses have to be a worthwhile event. Thank you very much for your attention.